Everyone, welcome to News and Brews Sports Biz, our podcast series that advocates for the financial voices in college athletics and features new developments impacting the business of college sports. I'm Katie Davis.
And I'm Ken Kurzel. And I'm so happy to finally have you back, as much as I love Shane and Brendan and others that we had while you were gone. I think I'm the happiest guy on the planet that you actually came back from sabbatical in Italy. I know we don't have all the gelato and all the great food and the wine that you had while you were over there, but we are amazingly happy to have you back.
I'm happy to be back, and I did love my time there in Italy. I also enjoyed being a podcast fan and listener instead of a speaker. I will say I only listened to the FAU podcast while I was in Italy. I drew the line at listening to a podcast about taxes while I was on sabbatical. Well, I waited for that one until
I got back. Understand that. Yeah, taxes are not anybody's favorite subject. So this month, we're going to talk about the California bill on revenue sharing, Assembly Bill 252. It's known as the College Athlete Protection Act. And while this bill was squashed in the state Senate in California this year, we know that the concept of revenue sharing, it's not going away. And we know that just like with NIL and so many other things, what starts in California ends up trickling out to the rest of the nation. So it's definitely something that everyone needs to have on their radar, regardless of where you are.
Yeah. And I mean, this definitely isn't an argument as to why you shouldn't have revenue share. We're not picking one side or the other. We're just letting you know that if things go that direction, some things that you can be proactive on. And I will caveat, we do realize there's also four federal bills in Congress right now around NIL or some other form of compensation of athletes. We don't plan to touch on those today. Honestly, with others I've talked to, I don't think anyone's really looking at those considering an election cycle's coming and those will probably go away anyway, quietly. But what we want to do is highlight what we think are the top things that college athletics business officers should know about the California revenue share bill so that you can inform and educate policymakers representing your institution, either at the state or federal level when the time comes. Revenue share, as we said, I don't think it's going away. And so the financial formulas used need to be fair and make sense. We think there's some really important key takeaways from this California bill that makes it worth this conversation right here. Even though the bill got squashed and it's been delayed a year, we think it's a good lesson learned and something that would make it worth the effort to be proactive here.
No, I strongly agree. And you're right, if I was a betting man, I would definitely bet on the fact that revenue sharing is gonna happen at some point, some way, somehow. So it's best to be talking about it and thinking about it ahead proactively. As to what it might look like. And specific to this bill, the California bill, one of the things that it would require if it had passed was for certain universities to establish what are known as degree completion funds. And in this case, the driver on whether or not you have to set up a degree completion fund or make contributions into it is whether or not you have $10 million or more in annual income derived from media rights. And that's both directly and indirectly, into the institution with their own media right deals that they negotiate, as well as indirectly through any conference distributions that that are driven by media rights. So, but a big but is that, as we'll touch on later, the media rights revenue is just the driver as to whether that law were to apply. The definition of revenue is much, much more broadly applied in our opinion, too broadly applied, related to the way they had it written. But the media rights was really what's going to drive whether or not you're in the category of having to do this or not. So if you were there was a cap of up to $25,000 per athlete that might go into the degree completion fund. The actual calculation is very complex, but that's the cap of what it would be. And that amount would be held separately from university assets and paid out upon graduation, and amounts would be forfeited if the athlete didn't graduate within 6 years of full-time enrollment in the way that they had the bill structured. The design of those funds really, it's very similar to what we see with employer-funded retirement plans, where you kind of have a fiduciary asset that's set aside that's not, you know, not your university assets any longer, but set aside in a fiduciary basis for the athletes.
Yeah, and our number one biggest concern with any kind of revenue share legislation is how the how revenue is defined. So what is the definition and what does that formula look like? So the California bill has defined revenue as annual intercollegiate athletics revenue as calculated and reported pursuant to the Federal Equity in Athletics Disclosure Act by an institution of higher education to the United States Department of Education. So we all know what the EADA is. And using the EADA definition of revenue is a terrible idea for many reasons. And I will get more into that because it's fun to just vent about it and give everyone some things to think about. But first wanted to clarify also in that formula, the bill is based on an incremental revenue increase exceeding revenue reported for the 2021-22 academic year. So that would be your baseline, and any revenue above that is subject to revenue share. But keep in mind that 2021 to 22 academic year was the 2021 football season, which was still partially impacted by COVID, and especially in California when especially they still weren't California. Allowing fans at the games. But so, you know, there's really two pieces. How is revenue defined? And then what baseline is being used if the formula is going to be based on incremental growth in revenue? But back to the definition of revenue. First of all, under the EADA, you have to report a balanced budget where revenue equals expenses. So in a year you're operating at a deficit, which many of you are, you're going to have a giant plug to revenue. And don't think it makes a whole lot of sense for athletes to be entitled to a share of that giant plug of money that does not exist. The EADA also doesn't break out the various categories of revenue. So there's no way to determine what's institutional support versus generated revenue. And, you know, does it make sense for institutional support that's going to pay operating expenses or fund facilities or things like that to be counted as part of revenue? Additionally, the bill, in California was picking up all revenue, which included non-sport specific revenue. And as that bill evolved, iterations began creating a circular reference as it related to institutional support and whether it counts as revenue or not, if the institution has to put more money toward athletics to support Olympic sports, because now the money from revenue generating sports would be going to athletes instead of supporting those other sports. And you see all over Twitter that there are a lot of arguments of, you know, Olympic sports shouldn't be the reason you don't share revenue. And we're not here to say one way or the other. But regardless, if you need to keep those sports, and in this bill, you can't cut sports. So it's going to have to be funded somewhere. And that would have to be through institutional support. So is there this circular reference that now more institutional support is going to mean
more revenue,
share and growth from that baseline year? And so I think, you know, they tried to define it, but regardless, someone with a financial mindset needs to take a look at that to try to understand all the key components and what the unintended consequences could be by how they're defining this. I do think that it's worthwhile for college athletics business officers to put their heads together and come up with a more reasonable definition of revenue that maybe just includes generated revenue and excludes all allocated revenue, such as institutional support and student fees, and also determine a more fair baseline for measuring revenue growth. I do think it's going to be hard given that not all of the institutions are subject to public records, so except for EADA. So I think it would be very difficult for you to use any other financial reporting framework. So it would have to be something that is reported in. And I don't know if it would make sense to use the NCAA report for this, you know, as this a means to this. And, you know, we talk all the time about how flawed even the NCAA financial reporting model is, but you can at least see where the different categories are coming from and carve out some of that institutional support that's going toward, you know, paying off debt or anything else. Right. So, you know, just putting your heads together and coming up with what you think is going to be more fair.
Yeah, as flawed as the NCAA report is that we oftentimes talk about some of the uniqueness of theirs, it's I think it is better than the EADA, which again, the definition of revenue there where you can't have a loss is, I've never understood that. I mean, just another thing thinking about that too. I mean, I guess like out-of-state fee waivers, which is, that's a revenue, yeah, but so it's not really a revenue. There's no cash there. It's just,
Tuition waivers would be revenue. Yeah. And in the case, like the state of Florida recently just passed, the ability to allow out-of-state tuition waivers. Mm-hmm. So if it were happening in Florida and they were using that 21-22 year as a baseline, there would be a significant growth.
Yeah.
And that's like no dollars whatsoever. And it's related to scholarships that are being paid to the athletes. Like, again, so many things that don't make sense.
Yeah, and I think they, if I recall correctly, help me on this, the California bill, did it at least exclude if a donor is giving a contribution for a capital asset? Did it exclude those from revenue?
It did. So there was one small caveat. It said if you were using contributions to pay for capital improvement, so renovation, new building, et cetera. Right. But I think that's related to contributions. I don't know that they specified if you got direct or indirect institutional support to cover some of the debt side of it.
Yeah.
Just a lot of different things to think about when it comes to revenue.
Oh yeah. Capital contributions might be excluded, but you have other restricted contributions that are given that, you know, really don't make sense to be in that part too. So the definition of revenue and that, the impact on that under this bill, if nothing else, you have a takeaway that let that be your key takeaway. That's definitely the biggest issue in our mind on it. But there are a few other areas that we wanted to educate you on that were in the California bill that we could see carried to other state legislation that would have a significant financial impact on athletic departments. A big one that you'll hear a lot thrown around, you know, both in the California bill as well as just ideas for this, is the area of insurance coverage during enrollment and then payment of out-of-pocket medical care in the years following their time as an athlete. We're seeing that again. We're not talking about the latest bills, but you know, this is getting talked about in a lot of different areas. You know, requiring out-of-pocket medical care to be covered and insurance. It is a little bit of a touchy subject, and it's probably not one to mess with from a public perception perspective. I don't think any athletic department's going to look good trying to fight against the idea of paying for health insurance, especially knowing that, okay, many players probably are going to have increased healthcare costs subsequent to their playing careers and what happened there. So that's not one to win on. I think it's definitely going to happen. Nevertheless, it is an interesting issue because you have a lot of these students who still are on their parents' policies, it does become an interesting question of, gosh, does that make sense when they already have good coverage? But again, not one that I would really be fighting on if I were the athletic departments on that. In terms of medical bills for former athletes, that's a really complex issue too, because, trying to figure out with all of the transfers that occur in the transfer portal, what school were they, like if they had an injury that led to future medical costs, figuring out may not be easy to identify where that occurred. Or is it just kind of even like cumulative, like maybe an injury occurred at one school, gets it dealt with, gets better, but then it recurs at another school, you know, so who's responsible for what? I can think of a lot of weird scenarios with all the transfers, and we've seen student athletes that have competed at 3 or 4 schools over the course of their college career. So
much less like if they go pro.
Yeah.
And then, you know, I think the hardest part is probably catching someone before they leave when they are going pro, but they're also more and more competitive in high school and earlier. So is it something that started there? So, I think, you know, making sure you're getting that, which most schools are doing an entry examination and they're doing regular examinations mm-hmm. while they're there, but you know, could you put in a provision to require an exit examination to be eligible for this? But even so, when you're moving around from year to year, like, I think it's going to be really hard to pinpoint who would be liable for that. Regardless, I also think whether it's law or not, someone will still probably come after a school legally if they have some major medical problem. I mean, they could come after you anyway. So So yeah, I agree with you, Ken. It's probably not worth the fighting that one and the public perception and looking bad by doing that, because you want to look like you're pro athlete, and which you are, but you need to be pro athlete from a financial standpoint of what makes sense. And that's where, you know, focusing on the revenue side is going to be key. But then understanding the other components and how they can impact you financially will also be important as you plan for your budgeting and where to find cuts to be able to fund some of these additional payments. But in making cuts, the bill does have accountability measures that would ensure that funds have not been cut from academic, medical, mental health, athletic training, nutritional support, to any of those services offered to athletes. You can't eliminate roster slots or reduce the total amount of scholarships. You can't reduce, I don't think you can even reduce cost of attendance. Your cost of attendance, I think, is expected to increase. And so your scholarships need to increase in line with that. And of course, you can't cut any sports entirely that would have existed as of that baseline year. So, you know, different iterations of the bill talked about who's responsible and what does that actually mean? And there's, of course, an oversight panel and all of that. But, you know, one of the versions of the bill talked about suspending the person in charge of athletics for 3 years for doing these things. And what does that even mean when, number one, the president or the athletic director is probably under contract? And is that written into their contract as it currently stands, but also who's in charge? You know, if they're looking at the athletic director, but at the end of the day, the president or chancellor has the seat at the table from the NCAA's point of view, and they're hiring the athletic director and the coaches that are making some of these poor decisions potentially that would impact athletes. I think it's really hard to determine who would actually be held accountable if they're not following along with this law. So I think, again, that's just going to be an interesting thing to watch play out. But from a financial perspective, what it's important to look at is the, you know, you can't cut basically anything that you would have control over. And pretty much what's left is payroll for those people that aren't supporting in those athlete services fields. So coaches' salaries, administrative salaries, and many of those are contractual and you can't exactly cut those. So
yeah, I don't know how you manage it. I don't have the answers on that one. And there's so many, many more questions that are raised with implementing some kind of revenue share model. Just a couple other examples. You know, again, what is the mechanism of this distribution to the athletes look like? I mean, we know that this is going into these, in the California case, it was a degree completion fund, but what does that look like from a standpoint? Does that run through financial aid as like going on the 1098-T as an award, scholarship award, or is it a 1099 issue? 1099s being what you pay to miscellaneous contractors, non-employee contractors, but of course, subcontractors. So if it's a 1099, you'd need to be very careful too, to structure it in a way that it wouldn't potentially trigger employment laws. And we don't want to get into that can of worms today, the whole argument of athlete as employee, but you know, that of course being talked about also, but if you did have a 1099, you're, you know, it's opening up that question of independent contractor versus employee.
Well, it's just that those unintended consequences of if you're going to run it through procurement as a 1099 for an independent contractor, there are laws out there that state, you know, it's related to, you know, control of their time and how they spend it. And I mean, that could inadvertently make them an employee without you intending to do that, or without legislation intending to do that. So, you know, just keeping those things in mind that once you put forth the mechanisms, that you want to make sure you're thinking through all of those
Yeah, definitely was going to, if this law had passed, it would have pushed even further towards the whole athlete as employee, I think, you know, just looking the way it was. And then also just looking at international athletes visas, you know, again, unintended consequences, other complexities that that we honestly don't have all the answers for.
Yeah, and the California bill, you know, there's also, of course, the Title IX issues, and that was addressed a lot in the California bill. That is way beyond our area of expertise, so we're not going to talk specifics on gender equity, but that is something else that needs to be considered. And as that bill evolved, it did start sharing some of that cut to all other sports, not just the sports that generated the revenue. So that was giving the ability for some athletes to benefit from revenue share, even if their sport didn't directly generate the revenue. But we know it's frustrating to be a business officer in college athletics right now. We see all the time, and we know how so often you have to swallow your pride as the bearer of bad news without the ability to actually problem solve. And maybe this is an opportunity for you to make a difference and get hopefully some job satisfaction in the process by being able to be proactive and problem solve ahead of time. If anything, it's always a good exercise to build rapport and extend that olive branch with someone else on campus. And so in this case, by getting to know government relations, at least they'll know who to go to when the time comes, because who knows who they might go to? They might go to the provost or the head of student life. Hopefully, they at least have some sense to go to athletics, but they might not go to the business office to get that feedback. So, just having that relationship, I think, will be huge whenever the time comes. And if nothing else, you've at least made a new friend on campus.
No, absolutely. So, well, Katie, once again, super, super glad that you are back and that you're back in the chair. And we're heading out this week, getting on the road, heading back to clients, and excited for kind of the kickoff of the new academic year, which is also our kind of busy time and all that. So,
Yeah,
gonna be
it's
looking forward
exciting
to it.
stuff.
So we will, I'm sure, hit various, whether it's breweries or other good places and all that, but. I didn't ask you, you didn't tell me what you had planned to share on your brews. I have a guess in the back of my mind that that it might have to do with red wine from Italy, but you know, I'll let you share what your brew of choice is going
I can't imagine the multiple cases of wine
to be
sitting in my office right behind you would tip you off that I'm going to talk about wine. So yes, I did send home to myself a lot of wine from Italy and had a great time drinking it. I'm going to talk today about Brunello. So there's a winery called Franco Picenti that I went to and did some wine tasting and got a case of Brunello sent back, and that's a very good Italian wine.
Nice, very good. Well, we haven't been out and about to various campuses here lately. Like I said, we're about to get out on the road again starting tomorrow. So looking forward to going to some breweries in different college towns. But I enjoyed this last weekend. We had a little firm get together and I got to buy the beer for that. So to prioritize good IPAs, and I was able to get some double dry hopped King Sue from Toppling
Ooh.
Goliath, which I think I've shared Toppling Goliath before, a wonderful brewery, and that was very, very yummy.
Yeah, so funny story about Italy. Multiple times I did actually inquire about beer, some of the places there, and multiple times the servers called IPAs IPAs. So I'm glad to be back in the land of IPAs.
Wonderful.
Well, thank you all for tuning in to this month's News and Brews. We wish you all a great start to the new academic year. Cheers.
Cheers.
To learn more about the James Moore & Company Collegiate Athletics and Higher Education segments, go to jmco.com. And don't forget to sign up for Insights to get our latest industry updates, news, and events delivered straight to your inbox. You can also follow us on Twitter at JMCO Higher Ed and on LinkedIn for the latest news as the landscape of collegiate athletics and higher education is continually evolving.